Is there a UK-US like distinction in terms of EB, and is there such a thing as, you know, some place ahead of others? Because we often talk about UK-US as like almost one contiguous thing, but there is sort of adoption differences, adoption rates are different, practices are different as well. So it'd be interesting to know what's going on there.
Well, a couple of years ago, I just did a LinkedIn search for people with the title employer brand manager. And I'm talking a good 4 years ago. And of the 1,300 people who turned up in the search, 800 of them were in Europe, which really surprised me. I think Europe understood this much faster than the States. It, you know, the US is so used to being the leader on everything. It's like, no, we have so much to learn and so much to catch up. It's been an interesting kind of yin and yang here.
I've got a really like weird theory on this. I wonder whether it's got anything to do with labor liquidity, in the sense that it's like people move around slightly less in Europe generally, because it's harder to harder to get rid of people, therefore it's harder to find people, etc. Right. Whereas US is a little bit more at will, so there's always a little bit more liquidity. I just wonder whether if you can always think, all right, there's loads of people, we can just like get them. And maybe you care a little less about EB. I don't know. Let me know, folks. I mean, do you think the UK or Europe generally is ahead of the US in terms of employer branding? We're just spitballing here to see whether that might be the case. Let me know in a comment. Anyway, we're live, everybody. So welcome to Brain Food Live on Air. It is episode 139. I'm bringing it to you every Friday. I'm super excited today because this topic is really, really interesting. I've always failed at doing this, by the way. So this is part of the reason why I'm really interested in this topic. How do you sell TA transformation to the business? And this is going to be a great show because we've actually got people who've done it and people who are currently doing it, because that is something, you know, they can really share what their current operating practices are. So that's going to be fascinating for us to keep in mind. Okay, so before we kick off, let's just do a few sound checks as usual. So we're live streaming it, obviously, here on Crowdcast. So if you can hear me on Crowdcast, just let me know whether you can hear me okay in a comment there. We should be multi-streaming this. We should be live in a lot of places, but I'm not sure whether we are. If you can hear me on LinkedIn, but please let me know, because we should be out there. And we should also be on Twitter and Facebook as well. So give me some sort of thumbs up, thumbs down, and let me know whether you can see me okay. All right. We have to say thanks firstly to our sponsors this week. Our sponsors are SparkStart. Maureen and I have been talking about this offline, and we're thinking, you know what, it's very interesting to look at the recruiting challenges that companies have this day and age. What kind of challenges do you have, and can you use video to solve those issues? We all know that recruiting is hugely problematic in 2022. Can you find the people? Can you attract the people? Can you engage the people? Are you getting a dropout rate from applicants that are coming through the pipeline? Are people starting once you've offered the job? Where can video be positioned to help you improve those numbers in those different places? So definitely you should check out SparkStart. They're one of the businesses that are really operating in this space. SparkStart.com. I'm going to share the link in the chat stream there as well, so you can check that out and make sure that's up there also. Of course, sometimes sponsors get to do some work as well. You know, you don't get this for free. Maury's stepping in and doing an hour with us in the co-host seat. So welcome to the show, Maury.
Great. Thanks, Song. It's fun to be here again.
Great stuff. So, Maury, I think most people would know you, but for the folks who don't, maybe you can just quickly introduce yourself. Like, what's your background and how did you, you know, end up being sort of running this business?
Yeah. What wrong turns did I take? I'm Maury Hannigan. I'm CEO of SparkStart. And actually, I started my career in marketing at Procter & Gamble. So I was a classic consumer packaged goods marketer, not an employer brand marketer, a marketing marketer. And it used to make me nuts that I would spend my day looking at storyboards and all these things we were doing to promote products. And then I'd sit down with HR because I'd have an opening on my team, and they'd show me this job description and say, oh, we're going to go market your job. And I'd go, huh? That's a compliance document. What are you talking about? That's not marketing. And I understand we all walk around with high def cameras in our pockets, and we have for decades. This is not bleeding edge technology. We've all had these cameras that work flawlessly. But I understand it's hard to do at scale. So I had been a computer science major as an undergrad. I don't read or write a line of code anymore. My skills are badly dated. But I'm not afraid of the technology. I love it. I understand pretty much you can do anything in code if you're patient enough and willing to write enough lines of it. So the question was, how do you make a platform that makes it simple, secure, and scalable? And that's what we did with SparkStart. And I love it because I think, as you know, Hung, we've had this conversation. I'm really passionate about talent acquisition. I think it's work that really matters, because when you get a good match, the candidate wins and the company wins. And I love spending my time and talent doing things where people win when you do it well. So this was obviously the area I was going to focus on, and then just bring the technology to make it easier for the recruiters and a better experience for the candidates.
And I think the timing is, I mean, you were ahead of the market, but the timing is so right now. Like the market in terms of video adoption, I think the concept is there. People want to do it. But there's still a huge amount that need to really make use of it, and an even bigger amount that haven't even maximized, you know, what you can do. So it should be great times going forward there.
Yeah, with all the automation going on, you know, that and all the processes, we've lost the humans out of it. And we all like to connect with other humans. And I think a lot of the problem going on with candidates not really being attracted or dropping out or not being sure they want to accept an offer, all of that, they just don't have that confidence that this is a place where I'm going to thrive. These are people that I'm going to learn from and work well with and all of that. Because we're all dealing at a kind of arm's length. There are no human faces. So the automation has to happen. You've got to do things efficiently at scale. But you know, in the same way that, you know, when COVID hit and we all sat at home and people were doing virtual happy hours, nobody said, oh, no reason for bars to ever come back, because we've all learned that you can sit at home and, you know, drink cheaper and, you know, have, it's like, no, bars are coming back. I'm sorry. There's a need to connect. And there is in the workplace as well. Doesn't have to be on site, but we do need to feel connected to people.
It's going to be, I mean, that's an interesting topic. I think one of the things maybe we could do as another idea for a show is how do we actually build relationships with people that we've never met? So I think right now, in terms of where we're at with remote and hybrid, is that we're getting along okay, but the people that we're working with and we're doing, you know, we seem to have great remote working relationships with is basically people we've already had a prior experience of working in person with. So we've already had a trust relationship built up. The next kind of group of people that we're going to hire, which we're hiring now, we've never met them. We've never been face to face. They're going to be physically more distant. Inevitably, that means we're going to be hiring further people are further away, and they may never, you know, have an in-person a reason to meet. How do we kind of make sure trust relationships are built there? That's going to be an interesting topic. Anyway, we've got another thing to talk about, talking about selling transformation. But before we do that, let's review the newsletter, Maury. Did you get a chance to read it last week? And if so, what was interesting for you?
Hung, you snag me every week. Every week I open this thing and go, I haven't got time to read this. And inevitably, I find myself going down the rabbit hole. There are always a couple of things. Not surprising, the first thing I clicked on was the story about the 12 different ways to use video. And I loved that. We see so many people who are like, oh, I'm going to do my recruiting video, my 2-minute, God forbid, generic, you know, we got the drone flight of the building sort of thing. But I love the different ideas of just letting your people talk. To be honest, my favorite example was having a video of somebody leaving the organization. I thought that was brilliant. The idea of someone just saying, thank you for my colleagues here. Thank you for all I learned. Man, that says volumes about an organization. We've seen really good examples of companies when they get over this idea that they have to produce this Hollywood kind of thing, and they let people talk. It's really powerful. It's really powerful. And I thought there were some great examples in that. And I thought there are even, you know, more places you can go with that. So that was a great one to think about. Don't think about what do I need a video for, but as you said earlier, what problems have I got in my process and where can video really be compelling and impactful and help connect people? So I thought that was the best article in there.
There's just so much like you can get just by being honest, isn't it? I mean, most people, if you think from a marketing perspective, would you ever like, you know, think of a lever as a person that would be a potentially a good asset to market your business from an EB point of view, to attract people, not to show them leaving. But here's an example of, look, that's a natural evolution of how people move through companies. You know, it's like nothing to be ashamed of, that people will eventually leave. And here it just says so much volume about the confidence of the company that they're happy to have an employee who's leaving the business talk about their journey and, you know, what they're moving on to. So it's almost like almost every sort of incident in your business is something that could be an interesting part of content for somebody to review.
And even internally, one of the best videos I saw that came out probably in April of 2020, when, you know, COVID was first starting, everything was locked down, retail was dead, hospitality was, you know, in a tailspin. We saw a video where the CFO made a quick video that they just shared internally that said, you know, we're cutting our costs everywhere that we can. We've delayed payments on this. We're doing everything we can to avoid layoffs, and we can't promise it'll never happen. But the entire finance department is focused on what do we need to do to have the cash flow so nobody loses their jobs. He could have put that same information in an email and it wouldn't have had a fraction of the impact. I mean, this guy, he recorded it at his kitchen table, right? No Dolby sound, none of that. He just talked to the employees and it was wonderful. You understood there was somebody there who really cared about securing your job. So, I mean, and there are so many other things we've seen, you know, product managers talk about, you know, the frustration of trying to get things to market and so forth, and just talk to people. And it's so much more powerful than anything that you could script, God forbid, you know, or overproduce. I hate to use the word authenticity because it's so overused, but sometimes just genuinely, honestly talking straightforward to someone is powerful in a way that you can't replicate any other way.
It you know, really there's another concept as well, Amore, I want to introduce here, which is this idea of over-preparation. I mean, I kind of obviously under-prepare. I mean, I screw up all the time. I've screwed up today. This is not going out on LinkedIn for some reason. But the point is, over-preparation kills the authenticity and it kills the story because people think, oh my goodness, I'm actually being sold to here. This person's reading from a script. We just even have to look at the political situation. I'm sure US is the same. UK is currently undergoing all kinds of like real criticism of political leadership. Big part of the problem is that we just get these canned answers or canned responses, yes, you know, PR washed type stuff. And we're just like, we're tired of it. Just tell us what's going on. You know, it really helps. And I'll tell you something. We might actually take this concept of video back into the topic of our talk, because how do you sell? Part of the transformation is, look, implementation, more wide use of video. How do you allow people to actually be more honest and authentic in using it? How do you get it out of marketing, so to speak? You know, how do you make sure the employees feel as if they're empowered to do this? That's part of transformation. So maybe something we can talk about. Anyway, I've just shared that link. It's from Stories. You should definitely check it out. Give us one more, Maury, or at least a couple more that you think was interesting from last week.
Oh, the two, I obviously read the one about New York requiring pay transparency, which I'm a big advocate of. I think particularly if you're ever going to get rid of the discrepancies, you know, particularly by gender and race and so forth, there's no way someone can negotiate pay if they don't know what other people are making. So that one I really appreciated. But then the other article that was really interesting was about countries understanding that they had an opportunity to either encourage immigration of high-skilled people, which would bolster their economy. And the idea that there are a couple governments that are awake enough to understand that there's this global competition now going on for the very best people. I was talking to a recruiter in Mozambique a couple weeks ago, and he was saying that the Dutch government understands right now that there is a global competition to find these incredibly smart tech people. And they're all over the world, right? Some of them are in Africa, some of them are in South America, some in APAC. And the companies that find them and, you know, harness all of their intelligence are going to be leading companies in the world. And the Dutch government, he claimed, understands that and is trying to figure out what policies and things they need to do to make it easy so the companies that win at that are Dutch companies. And I thought, what contrast to my own government, who's finding more reasons to keep immigrants out rather than tap the power. But it's really interesting to see different pockets around the world where there's an awareness of what's going on with this entire global talent migration. It's changing dramatically. And some people are wide awake and understand that there's just phenomenal talent everywhere and they just have to find it and tap it. And other people are I don't know. They're reading different things than I'm reading.
Yeah, you know
so to
what?
speak.
It's basically people looking at the prism from a slightly different facet. And the article I think you mentioned was fascinating because it kind of is trying to extrapolate the implications of a remote first world. Like, what does it actually mean in terms of, where the job is actually performed? If it is location irrelevant, which, remote is, then that should apply from in any geography. Maybe time zone is maybe the only thing you could argue on that case, in which case a lot of those jobs will go to the places where employers will get best value. And these will be atypical sort of locations that we wouldn't normally think of, but it might give those organizations and those regions a real competitive advantage. We actually have really interesting examples of regions like trying to attract digital nomads in order to actually build a remote talent pool. If that makes any sense, it's like, okay, we're going to get remote workers, but we need to attract them in so that they can work remote back to where they came from. It's like,
Well,
that's.
I don't know what Portugal's doing. I know several people from the States are in Lisbon. And I don't know if Lisbon is just being more open or welcoming, or it's a wonderful city. Like, who wouldn't want to live in Lisbon? But there seems to be a real migration. So, yeah. And the other piece is, yes, there can be remote jobs. Not every job can be remote. So what else are you doing? Find the talent and make it easy for companies to have it, whether that's remote, whether it's on site, whether it's some hybrid, or just to your point about, at some point, do we meet and build those personal connections that then allow us to work more efficiently when we're remote? Like, what are you doing to facilitate that? There's a bigger picture here than just, oh, let's hire a guy in this country. Let's hire a woman here. It's like, no, let's think about how do we really build our own talent community and have the best people and have them work efficiently together.
There's definitely a huge opportunity. And by the way, I don't know whether anybody from Portugal is listening to this, but the Portuguese are, and even though that it's not so, like, straightforward, because every kind of immigration policy it will attract controversy no matter what how you position it. But certainly it's very well positioned as the place that people should relocate to for a lot of reasons: tax reasons, food reasons, lifestyle reasons, but also, time zone, language also. There's lots of arrows pointing in that direction. So I think big
Food.
opportunity. Yeah, food's amazing, right? I could do with more tomato ketchup though. I mean, what's going on with the lack of condiments? Half of Portugal just had a heart attack. I'm joking. Oh, don't use tomato ketchup. No need. All right. Let's move on to the topic of choice. Let's bring on some of our guests. But before we do that, I'm gonna ask you the question, Maury, because maybe you've had an experience of this. Working in bigger companies, trying to sell something to an audience that can say no. I think that's the thing, right? It's different. I'm not talking about change where you are in charge of the department. You can say what happens and force it in. No, we're talking about selling it to a function or a business that can veto it or can obstruct the approach. What have you learned in your career, Maury, that you can say, you know what, typically, if that's going to happen, you need to nail these things. Otherwise, that's guaranteed to be a problem down the road.
Well, the first one is understanding the difference between saying no and actually changing your behavior. We see TA leaders all the time. They go out to the business, they go, look, the market's changed, the tools have changed, here's what we need to do to be competitive. And everybody now, okay, I got it, got it, got it, got it, got it. And they run through the numbers. There's what right now there's in the US, there's 0.7 candidates for every open job. So this idea that you're going to have a slate of, four or five or six qualified candidates you get to interview and pick between and, take your time deciding, you can run people through all those stats and go, look, we'll find you a highly qualified candidate, interview them. If they meet your requirements, we're going to make an offer, immediately. And people can talk the talk of, yeah. And then it's like, well, I'm not sure I want to see some more people. I think that's the real challenge. It's not intellectually convincing them, but they fall back to the old habits. So how do you get them to change the behavior? How do you get them to either adopt the tools or feel comfortable doing something different? Or, it used to be eight people had to interview a candidate before you'd make an offer. We wanted everybody. It's like, no, we don't have that luxury anymore. How many people do we really need? You see it all the time with applications, companies that still have these 45-minute long applications. You can talk the talk of we're losing candidates because this is just too long and they're dropping out. And then you get down to, oh no, but we have to have that question for compliance reasons. And no, we do need that up front, really. Like, why? It's changing the behavior. That's the big thing. And when I see the difference, it's not just a TA leader who has the vision of what needs to change and so forth, because they're out there. It's the ones that have the plans to change the behavior. Like, what are the things that need to happen so people behave differently? So they automatically pick up this versus that. They automatically, you know, respond this way rather than that kind of thing. It's the implementation plan. It's not the vision. Vision is easy.
Sorry, Maura, I interrupted you there. Can you finish your comment?
Then I got, vision is easy was my big finish.
That was ruining everything, Hunga. You're ruining everything. No, but I tell you what, implementation problems, like, we often forget about this. Like, I actually, sometimes I get a little bit annoyed at the visionary, so to speak, to, you know, keep like exhorting change. And it's like, okay, great. I totally get it. We should improve on this, but have we calculated the implementation challenge? And we have to alleviate that and make sure people can switch to this new thing more easily, because that's actually one of the big barriers to stop it from happening. So that's something very important to think about, the implementation cost, the switching cost of it. Cool. Okay, let's bring on our guests, Maura. Let's have them talk to us about this. Who is it coming on? I think we've got Ben, if he's there. There he is. Let's try and bring him on. I believe Paul is around as well. Let's hope he is. There he is. And I think Alan, I feel guilty, but she's got up early. Hopefully a couple of coffees in. Let's bring Alan in as well. Bring everyone in. Cool. There we go. Oh, there we are. At least two of them. So let's do some intros. Okay, Ben, do you want to go first? Like, who are you or what it is you do, sir?
Yeah, we'll do. Hi, everyone. Hope you're all well. Whatever time zone you're logging in from. So, my name's Ben Gledhill, and I'm 6 weeks into my new gig at World Remit as VP for Global TA.
Fantastic stuff. I noticed you're wearing some sort of sports gear there. I don't know whether you're like just coming off some sort of live stream with Man United or something. Is it Man United?
Wash your mouth out, Jesus. No, this is just a, yeah, if you've got any rugby fans on, this is the world famous Lions, which is obviously a combination of all of the
home countries.
Ireland, Wales and England, yeah.
Fantastic. It's a nice jacket. Okay, we have Alan as well. But before we go to Alan, Paul, can you quickly introduce yourself? Who are you? What is you do?
Sure. I'm Paul Magson. I've been in talent and talent acquisition for a little over 35 years. Last 25 years or so with PwC, Unilever, and then for the last 6 years nearly, I've kind of been doing my own thing. But I'm back for a second stint as VP for talent acquisition across the EMEA region for Publicis Sapient, which is the digital transformation part of the Publicis group.
That's the a boomerang hire, Paul. So
I'm a boomerang hire. So I'm.
You didn't mess it up so badly last time that that has prevented you from being brought back in. So well done on that. Okay, moving on. And Alan Bailey, great to see you, Alan. For the people who don't know you, which I don't think is anybody, but for the people who don't, can you quickly introduce yourself, who you are, what it is you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name's Lynn Bailey. I am I'm operating a new consultancy around transformation and TA transformation called Transformation Tapas. Prior to that, and over the course of the last decade, I've worked with TA organizations, big, small, medium, driving change at a variety of different levels. Started doing it from a recruitment marketing perspective, and then it built it out to this larger story of kind of how does all this fit together. So that's me.
Fantastic stuff, Alan. So listen, welcome everybody to the show. I think all of us have got varying experiences of this. A lot of people actually have started the new year, obviously in new jobs. Whenever you get a new job, particularly in a leadership role, it's quite rare that it's just ticking the boxes, business as usual. Like I don't see a scenario where, oh yeah, just come in, just do what the last guy did. No, you're there, you're brought in there to really try and do a step change improvement. But then that's a change management task. So I wanted to ask the question, like, what do you think is the most common challenge for talent acquisition when they're trying to like implement or do a change within the business? Any thoughts on this? Let's go to you first, Ben. Any thoughts on that question?
Yeah. I've kind of gone into the swimming pool in the past 6 weeks without any armbands and just literally with concrete bricks around my ankles. So everything is credibility. Let's be honest with you, TA leaders need to be speaking to that top table, you know, whether it's C-suite, chiefs, whatever. And from my experience, if you're leading any change and transformation, you need immediate buy-in through credibility. So I know it sounds quite basic, but, you know, whether that's through a solid project plan, through data, through metrics, you have to, from a very, very early stage, establish a level whereby people can buy into and agree what you're wanting to do. And I think that's one of the main reasons why, I hate to say it, whether it's employer branding, candidate experience, why a lot of transformations don't work, because you don't get the foundations right.
All right. So there's two things there that I think are quite important to register. Number one, the credibility challenge. So we need to, you know, they need to trust that we can do what we say we're going to do. I think that's what credibility is. But you also mentioned like immediacy, like you have to establish that early. You can't like soft shoe that. You got to really get in with the credibility early. So I wonder whether, let's talk on the earliness, the immediacy aspect of this. What do you see like TA people typically make a mistake on in terms of failing to immediately establish this position? Alan, any thoughts on that one?
Yeah, well, I think one of the biggest things that happens is that they walk in, they see a huge amount of change that needs to happen. They build this huge project plan and execution plan in front of them, and they try and sell the whole enchilada, and it feels too remote, too far away. People can't visualize it. They can't get into it. I think Ben's right on. The idea of immediacy is, what can you do right now? What can you do opportunistically that shows people something that makes their lives feel different and better immediately, and then build from there, right? Sometimes you got to hide the vision for the, right? And just hit the little pieces, piece by piece.
All right, so you're talking about quick wins.
Let me just jump in, because both of them danced around something. Ben, you also mentioned data. The credibility piece is you got to come in with the data, and I see HR often doesn't have the really solid data. But to Alin's point as well, when you do the quick hits, you can show people the successes. When you've got a couple of things that have really produced results, you can turn around and say, look, we did X and we got Y for it. Now, let's go ahead and do the other pieces. That's a piece of the discipline that I think is absolutely critical.
So hang on. To change behaviors and to deliver change, I think there's so much that's already been said. I think the starting point is actually to have alignment on what problem or sets of problems you're trying to solve. Mm-hmm. Because unless, whether it's the C-suite through to hiring managers or key stakeholders within an organization, I think to mitigate a risk, the biggest risk is actually coming in and then presenting to the whole enchilada bit, a fully mm-hmm. formed solution. When you haven't appeared to have complete alignment on what the problem sets of problems are that you're trying to solve. And that's the first risk to not getting buy-in.
All right. I think it's worth a quick summary, because there's loads of brilliant ideas. I hope someone's making notes, because I'm not. So one of the things that was clear here, look, can we get some like quick wins, like maybe a very quick way to establish credibility? You may have a week or two at the beginning where you can get away with just like charisma, I guess, or, you know, like just gravitas, walking with a bit of gravitas, get away with that. But then some people are going to say, right, what is this person actually doing? You got to identify some quick wins and immediately try and deliver that, and then make an improvement that's visible, tangible, people can see it. And then they say, okay, this person can actually do this. Let's give them a bit more. Second thing, Paul, you mentioned, you got to understand the problem set. Like, don't come in rolling in with a predefined, this is how you do it solution, which may have worked for you in whatever context you came from, but actually you need to understand like the nuances within this context before you either moderate this plan or even change it radically to suit this situation. Lynn, you mentioned one thing I thought was super interesting was, look, don't swallow the entire ocean in one take, because it's too much for people to take. It's like you've got to modulate it. So this reminds me a lot of the waterfall versus agile kind of argument, isn't it? It's like you've got to try and have an iterative approach to it, because you've got to give people modules and pieces to chew on, rather than, you know, and that may build into a grand vision at some point, that all of those pieces will slot into what you want to achieve. But if you're spending time, you know, first 30 days, 90 days, like drafting some presentation, that's just simply not going to do the job. Okay.
But Hank, let's make sure people don't misunderstand that while you've got to implement it in bite-sized pieces, you still need to have a vision. To Paul's point, like, what are the problems we're trying to solve here? Because you don't want to change something and then back out of it because, oh, gee, we didn't think about this. There needs to be a vision. But the implementation has to be in bite-sized pieces so people can adapt it. But you've got to think through it. Just go in and let's try this and let's try that and let's try that. That's not going to get you there either. And that, to Ben's point of credibility, you can't undo what was, you know, yesterday's priority because you hadn't thought about tomorrow's, you know, new challenge.
And I think something else as well, and I absolutely totally agree, with that. But I'm going to release my first bomb of the session. So, you know, the ongoing debate on LinkedIn, Twitter, and all the rest of it is, does TA need a seat at the top table? I will stick to what I've said from the get-go. We absolutely do not. We just need to understand the exam question, or to Paul's point, the wider business problem. And I'm going to kind of pick on what Tom's said there. You know, transformation may be something as small as introducing a TA dashboard, but that TA dashboard will absolutely revolutionize the way that an organization looks at talent. So, and I think sometimes we get a little bit blindsided by technology solutions, VR, whatever this is. So it's that thing of just, again, look at the basics. And I think also as well, don't get distracted by things like maturity curves, you know, maturity models, because every single organization is at different steps. So yeah, I think it's just a case of, you know, I think you'll get that credibility early doors from my experience, from truly understanding the exam question rather than providing the answers before you know it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it completely makes sense, Ben. And I think what's critical about that is that in order to do that, like to figure out those little kind of wins in that space and do that, you have to be able to absorb and understand what the problem statement is. And you need to understand what are you designing for, right? So then you know that dashboard is the thing that's going to create the most impact or the most value right then, right? You get it in the door and you're working off a set of core design principles. And once you have that, you can go at any pace.
Is it worth looking at it from a negative point of view? So in other words, trying to examine what is missing in the current state, and then filling in a quick hole. So that seems to me like a way to surface up what could be a quick win, for instance. So, you know, you Ben, you mentioned like a dashboard. If they didn't have a dashboard, which you think by this stage maybe they should, that seems to me like a hole in the road. You fill that hole and basically that's going to be like clear progress. And then that road gives you, you know, a little bit more of a smooth running for the next challenge that you need to take on. Is that making sense, or is that like bad advice or what?
No, not really. I say it's just what I mean. And, you know, going back to what I said, the dashboard could be a brand new careers website. It could be a new piece. So whatever the solution is, make sure that it fits the problem. I you know, for example, at A World Dream, it being really honest, we're on a whole new journey. You know, we're literally fixing the basics. So don't go into an organization with that predefined transformational, I'm going to be a rock star. You'll be a rock star by fixing what needs fixing. But I think that's the thing that I'm trying to get across.
I want to come back to that as well, because I wonder whether there are like people, and of course they are, because this is true for any industry or any circumstance, that, you know, have an agenda about their own kind of personal positioning as a, you know, a hugely innovative leader or whatever it is, and they're going to go in and do like particularly innovative things, even though it may not be context appropriate, let's say, because it's going to be good on the CV for the next job or something like this. So that's something maybe we can go back to at a later point. But let's have a look at sort of another thing that we need to just examine a little bit. People are down in the chat stream there saying, look, you need to have some you need to evidentialize your claims. So in other words, you need to have some data to back up what you're saying. Now, can you explain to us, like, what do we mean by this? And is that actually true? I mean, what are we talking about here? Paul, you were nodding there. Do you want to give this one a shot?
Well, you do need some data points to back up anything is saying, but not just data, because there's it's a bit like possession's 9/10 of the law. Even if, you know, I've got this pen, I may have 3 other pens, but you can't see them. that's mm-hmm. still information. But notwithstanding that, data is also a point of credibility. And many organizations sell transformation to their businesses. I'm working for one at the moment, to their clients, and find it really challenging to transform themselves because they're not operating or manifesting the same behaviors that they encourage with their clients, not taking their own Kool-Aid. To the point of business acumen, business is, and successful businesses, take it outside of talent acquisition for the moment and hiring, are informed by data. Yeah, if they're listed on a stock market or intending to get an IPO, or they're a startup going to Series A, B, and C, and so on and so forth, they're not going to get what they want to unless they can provide their stakeholders, finance, with data to support that. And professionalizing our own industry, we necessarily have to be supported by data, and we need to find that data. But in terms of transformation, what our systems provide in terms of data is only as what you get out of it tends to be what you put into it. It's a bit like a sewer in that respect. And that's been an age-old problem. So it's one thing presenting the data, but before you present it, you need to ensure that you've assessed the integrity of that data as well. And I think what it will provide, and this is about going right back to what I was saying earlier about addressing the problem or the sets of problems, and that has to be business-wide rather than, you know, certain allowed individuals or teams' agendas. So to your point, Ben, I can absolutely agree that you don't need a seat at the top table, but talent acquisition does need to be part of the business than be a business partner. And then as such, you're going to need to get your own assessment from what the problems are from the top table in order to develop your solution, your vision, strategy, and solutions. And then within that, I'm prattling on, I don't mean to, there's a difference between presenting what's urgent and what's important. They're not necessarily the same thing.
Mm. And we can come on to that. Yeah. Go ahead. I'm going to pose what may sound like a slightly controversial statement around data. I do think that you're absolutely, everything you said about data is correct in terms that it is important for us to have it. It's important for us to understand it, to leverage it, to help them make choices and decisions, and to be able to reference it when needed. But I honestly have not found in my experience that data is what drives transformational change, or that is the thing that people are going to, like, with enough data, with the best PowerPoint presentation, with the right data arguments made, that you're suddenly going to sit in front of leaders and they're going to go, aha, yes, let's make that change, right? There is a pre-sell that happens before you even get to the data conversation, which is around creating some sort of emotional trigger for people. Yep. Something they can emotionally align to that says, I feel pain here in some way, either empathetically for others or for myself. And it is strong enough that I'm willing to look at this data and be influenced by it, because they see data in, day in and out, right? Coming at them, and they use it. You can use data to convince yourself of just about any side of an argument at the end of the day, right? Your job as a transformation leader is to say, how can I build a sense of urgency around this from an emotional perspective so that when you look at this data, you see what I'm seeing it, that it's telling the same story and we can use it to move forward with.
All right. So that's actually, let's just pause a second on that, because Lynn, I think that was a controversial statement. I think when people hear you say, hey, you know, data's great, but you know, there's actually a bigger piece before that. Most people think, oh my goodness, what's happening? This is against the grain of what I've been chewing on. But there is evidence that the big commitments that we make, be they business or life or whatever, is based on like these emotive things. I mean, I think someone was mentioning Brexit in the channel chat stream there. Absolutely non-data-driven conversation, right? Like, literally, we had all the data available. We weren't interested. We decided to go with the emotional resonance and made a bad call, I think. So I think that's a really important point to make. Like, you need to try and surface up.
I think the data has to ring true, you know, and I think to Lynn's point, you've got to have some kind of invested or some exposure. You know, if I told you that, you know, 7.6% of something went sideways, if you have no connection to it, it's just a number.
All right.
But when somebody says, you know, we don't have enough candidates, or the candidates we're offering are getting, you know, 20% more money, and you've just lost a candidate because your offer wasn't competitive, then that really resonates with you. So yeah, I think the data has got to have some kind of sort of core credibility or connect with something that makes reasonable sense to people. Otherwise, it's just numbers. And there's so much bad data out there.
All right. Let me just say this now, Maury, because I think I'll forget otherwise. How do you, as a TA person, just coming into this new company, how do you surface up what is emotionally resonant? Like, how do you know what the real pain points are? That would help you kind of create change. But what are the techniques, the tools, maybe? What can we do to find that information, find that truth out? Any thoughts?
You have to ask. I mean, it sounds basic, but I mean, really, you just have to ask, right? You have to talk to people. You have to ask. You have to watch. You have to pose hypothesis to them and say, I'm seeing this. It seems to me that would be challenging. Is it? And let them respond to it and honestly give you feedback. And then you have to synthesize all that data and feed it back to them. You know, there's a strategy that I learned early on in my career, a brilliant individual who actually came from a comms background. And he said, anytime you're looking at a situation, you're trying to help people connect information or to understand what it means to them, you have to do something called linking and labeling, right? You have to be able to listen to what they say, feed back to them what that was in terms of label it for them. Oh, you express this. It means I'm seeing what that means is that you're having this experience, and you connect it, you link it, you label it, and you link it to a particular experience. And then you get them to agree or disagree. And if they disagree, they'll tell you, right? They'll articulate how it's different, and you have to take in that information and kind of continually feed it. I think good transformation leaders have to be really good listeners, and they have to be really good at dissecting the underlying experience that they're seeing. The why. There was a great thing on LinkedIn yesterday that made me all excited. And it was about the idea that you can understand the what all day long, but if you don't understand the why, you can't make any motion on it, right? And the why, you can look at that when you actually watch people, listen to people, and ask.
We have two eyes, two ears, and one mouth for very good reasons.
Can I say one thing here? This is very exciting to me, but how do we do that in a scalable way? Because suddenly, yes, I want to go and listen to everybody. There's 100 hiring managers there for me to deal with. Like, I can't go one-to-one with all of them, even at the best of times. What is the way in which I could surface up that information in a efficient way Or is that not possible? I mean, do we just simply have to take that trade-off and say, you know what, we can just do as best we can with this volume of people, start there and maybe, you know, move it on step by step?
It's completely possible. No, I'm sorry. I was going to throw my UX piece there. It's completely possible. So first thing I'll tell you is that people get afraid because they think in order to understand what 100 people are thinking, you have to talk to 100 people. You know, they say from basic ethnography research, right, that it really, after you talk to about 5 people, you should start to see a trend emerge, right? If you don't after 5, talk to more. But if you start to see a trend after 5, you've talked to enough people. Now you need to just go and articulate what you saw and get others to verify it. And that becomes easier. So don't get panicked about the number. Instead, start thinking about when do you start to see a trend? Can you label it and get people to start responding to it?
Right. So the technique there is like sampling. You basically try and find a representative sample. You have basically an ethnographic interview. Try and pick out some trends that are important to them. And then, as you say, you kind of create a language around that makes people be able to conceive it as an issue. We get a lot of kind of criticism sometimes for coinage of new terms or whatever it is, but sometimes you need to have a way to describe a particular situation so that everyone else can grasp, oh, this is actually the scenario. That's a really interesting technique. Ben, you're about to say something?
Yeah, I was going to back up what Alan was saying. Obviously, you know, we've had many chats before, and I think we're built on the same thread. But you know, empathy and understanding are the two biggest tools you'll have as a TA transformational leader. Method, mean, all the rest of it. You know, the classic things. I mean, I've used, you know, workshops, surveys, focus groups, exec interviews. I think they're all level one. You know, what all we're trying to do is get some data that we can take away and analyze. I think for me, the only other thing to add is give everybody a voice. You know, I've done some transformations in some huge organizations whereby, you know, certain elements maybe feel that they don't have a voice or not listened to. Just make sure that the actual kind of the data and the insights that you're capturing covers all those bases. But yeah, I wouldn't get too hooked up on size, because we all know from the science that, I was gonna say size doesn't matter, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, because Baz wants to, and I only speak for Baz because he seems to want me to make a comment. Once the problem's been assessed and agreed on, then and again, before you get to the change and the change dynamics, you then need to agree a business case and a financial model around that, and who's going to benefit. Those benefits can be financial, they can be time-based, so long as they have, on the one hand, beneficial outcomes for individuals and business leaders, but those beneficial outcomes are really business beneficial outcomes. You know, is it going to make the business more profitable? Are we going to get more clients? Sometimes we think too locally in terms of what we want to change, whereas actually we're supporting the business. We're part of the business, and the objective and the outcome is business success. Now, that business success is in part, but not exclusively, predicated by hiring success. But in order to achieve that, again, it involves a transparent business case and financial model that is ultimately going to lead to all that.
You know what? I think that's a really important sort of observation, Paul, because we're talking now about that summarization point, aren't we, Lynn? Where you know, you've extracted some information, you do have to pitch it back in some way. Let's talk about how we do that. Like, what is the best format for that communication? But before we do it, folks, we always have a little break in the middle of this show, because look at the time already. We're like flying through this conversation really quick. I'm sure this is like a really interesting topic of conversation for all of us. So very, very important that Brain Food Live is never a bottleneck for this conversation. If you want to continue this chat, you can please connect with everyone else who is participating in this show, but connect with all of the people watching this show. Share your LinkedIn profile in the chat sidebar. Do it now and make sure that you connect with everyone here. Basically, everyone is passionate about the same topic. please continue the conversation without sort of relying on Brain Food Live still being live, because guess what, we're going to come off air in about 10 minutes 15 minutes or so. So take a moment and share your LinkedIn in the chat bar. Okay, let's talk about how to construct this story. We've collected a bit of information, we want to pitch it back. Paul, you mentioned something super interesting, was that you have to reconnect actually the recruitment kind of gains with the business. In other words, you can't want to say, hey, we've, you know, reduced time to hire to this and, you know, lead with that. You got to explain what the reduction of time to hire means to the bottom line of the company, right?
Yeah. You know, a reduction of time to hire in and of itself doesn't mean you're actually getting the best people that's going to make the biggest business, most successful business outcome. So sometimes, you know, that's the other, which is, you know, why are we measuring this? What are we measuring and why are we measuring it? As I said, time to hire is not a mutually exclusive measure of business success. It may be, but it isn't necessarily. So I've lost my train of thought. What was the point?
Don't worry.
Paul, because my thought as I was listening to this is, well, people will give you lip service about, yes, the business goals, we're going to make more money, more clients, and so forth. I find what motivates them is when they make their own objectives. It's kind of, if you're going to make your annual objectives, whether you're talking at a department level or an individual level, and yes, that feeds up to the business goals, but there's that translation to what I care about. You know, I care about that bonus check at the end of the year. Yeah. And to get that, I need to have X amount in sales or profit or whatever. I think that's a critical piece to, yes, the big picture business results are there, but very few people change their behavior for that. It's too abstract. It really is much more down to, if this department is going to make our annual goals and meet our annual numbers, we better get the people in here that we need so we get there. And how do you do that translation?
Well, that's a good point. So I was coming to that because they're all connected to business outcomes, you know, whether they're KPIs or OKRs or whatever, they roll up. And you're right, if somebody's or team's individual or collective reward and remuneration is based on their outcomes, how are you going to make life easier for them and more likely to achieve those outcomes, then that in and of itself is a business objective. But actually having the bums on the seats doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to achieve those objectives, which is why I think you just need to sometimes have a slightly more in-depth conversation and use the two eyes and two ears to enable that and to facilitate that.
All right. I just want to underline Maury's point, because that's actually a really smart observation. Mm. It's all very well looking at the business objectives as the unit of analysis. But let's not forget, businesses are made up of human beings with their own agendas and their own goals and their own sort of demands that are obviously not always entirely aligned with that business. So you need to understand what the hiring manager or, you know, the person you're meant to be supplying the talent to, what does he or she need to do in order to achieve her goals and her objectives and, you know, make her kind of succeed in her task. Understanding that is maybe a key to converting that person into like an advocate or a champion for you, rather than someone who is a blocker or an antagonist, which I want to talk about now, because I think it's almost inevitable that you get into a situation, you know, where you might find someone who you've identified in the business is, you know what, I think this person is trying to obstruct me here. Like, have you had that experience? And if so, how do you recommend dealing with it? Let's go around the clock on this. Ben, thoughts on this? And if you haven't, say you haven't. I think that's totally cool. But if you have, do let us know.
What, a blocker?
Yeah, someone who's just, you think you've had enough evidence to think this person's like obstructing me.
Smash them. No, I'm joking. I've got the lines top on, what can I say? No, again, I think it's about... Maybe I'm too half on, I will hurry up, but I'm a true believer that nobody sets out to be an arsehole. I really, really do believe that. Maybe I'm too dreamy, but that's my view. So I think it's just about really understanding where is that person coming from. Because from my experience, it's usually fear. Your change is going to change my world. your transformation is going to transform my world negatively. So it's just understanding where they are coming from. And again, it's just going back to that whole, that empathy piece and just trying to kind of, you know, get to the root cause of people's feelings. That's my view.
Would you like have a soft confrontation with that person? Like, would you directly address it to say, listen, I get the sense that you and I aren't seeing eye to eye. Why don't we have a break and talk?
Yeah, I would, because I've done before, and I think if you do it in the right way, look, let's be honest with you, there are people that we meet in our journey as human being that you just will not get on with. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think if you just take it down to level, look, I have a role to do in the same way as you do. Can we just have a really open and honest and polite conversation to get over this bump in the road? And if not, then you pull in your chief people officer, you pull in whoever. But I'm a believer of just take an inch off and spend a minute in their shoes and then take it from there.
Yeah, very good. How about you, Lynn? Any thoughts or experience on this? Like when you've encountered someone, you think, wow, this is my nemesis. Like, what have I done to this person?
Yeah, it feels like a constant. No, that's not true. As I listen to Ben, my instinct is to want to say I completely agree with that, right? That I want to believe that people have good intentions, and that and most of the time we can come to some sort of alignment by treating each other like human beings and connecting. I will also tell you I have had enough experiences at this point to realize that there are going to be some people out there that have an agenda that is opposite of yours and purposely antagonistic of yours. And that is, and you're not going to move that ship. And you need to identify that as quickly as possible, right? And when that happens, you have a couple choices to make, right? One, can you figure out a way around them, right? So get your strategy game on and figure out how you work a way around them in a way that does not make it look like you're confronting directly, because that's not going to be helpful in your environment. Or two, there are times when you have to, I hate to say this, when you have to throw your hands up and go, this blocker's so big and powerful and blocking so strongly and so adamant that there is nothing I can do to get around this. And walk away and find another place to go and drive your, to go and be supportive at. I know that sounds harsh, but I think too many times we've talked to people about bootstrap yourself up there and get in there and build those relationships and et cetera. And we don't face the reality that sometimes it's not going to be possible, and that's okay. Don't kill yourself.
I've had a couple of self-serving assholes in my time.
Hang on, Paul. Before I let you go, I just want to sort of, there's a third option that Lynn didn't talk about there. You can either have the conversation Ben style. You can make the early decision. You can work around this person is the second option, or you can decide to walk away. Third option is, can you sabotage that person, or can you distract them with something so that they're doing something else, and you know you can get on with what you're doing? I mean,
to me that's part of the workaround. I mean, sometimes my get around you is to say, huh, maybe I can treat you like my cat and show you something nice and shiny over here,
right?
And you'll get interested in, you'll go play with that for a while, and then I'll throw something else, I'll distract you over here, get somebody else to do. Sure.
Oh, yeah. Right. This is where you've got to be political at some point. Paul, sorry to interrupt you, but I want to just put that one in there. How about your thoughts on dealing with a blocker?
Well, I was just going back to the self-serving arseholes, and one of the ways around it, I mean, I take the point about blowing stuff up. That's not always the most constructive way. Perhaps a more constructive way is actually really identifying allies. And allies within the business that, and if those allies significantly outweigh the blocker, then you'll have more chance of, because, you know, multiple allies outside of talent acquisition in a business will help your case with the blocker.
And that's also called, I think, something like indirect influence, isn't it, Paul? Yeah. Where you're not like you're influencing directly yourself, but you can kind of recruit a few people that can also, you know, be around that conversation, or they can have a conversation offline with them, and there's a soft influence, the ambient influence, if you like, going in there, and that help nudge their their behavior in a certain way. Okay, this is great. Listen, we're running short on time, but I want to ask one final question, because it could be that you've achieved something with your change. How do you go and communicate that? RTA too quiet about it? Are we too loud? What is the best way, what is the best way to increase, to elevate the visibility, I guess, of what the TA team are doing? Any thoughts on this? Let's go around again on it. Maury, you can come in on this one as well, but let's go to Ben first with this idea.
Right, right. I'm the youngest here. Can I have a free pass, Paul? You go first.
All right. I don't think we've ever had a flat refusal to answer a question before on the history of Breakthrough Live.
Why does it always mean I have to go first? Somebody else can.
I'm literally looking at the clock, like looking around the clock as my screen is displayed. But that's okay. We'll come back to you, Ben, on that. Paul, how about you? You've been nominated. How do we elevate the story of TA once we've actually done something positive?
In whatever platforms, internally and externally, you just amplify the story.
Okay. Can you explain what that is? I mean, how polished does it need to be? Is it an email from you?
It needs to be polished. I mean, you can be part of the internal comms cascade. Yeah. What's the the all hands in a, I'm talking about companies of a certain size, but you don't need, all hands can be regional by craft, small, big, or medium in size. But if you're part of the business, then you're part of the all hands, the success can be celebrated through those. And then you that's one way of amplification. Another is the more formal route through sort of internal comms, and then amplify externally through your own external channels as well. Because sooner or later you might start to attract talent.
Well, Stephen's just mentioned, go on the speaking circuit and talk about it. I mean, if you almost externally market your achievements, and then you actually some internal people might think, oh, hang on, that's awesome. This person is like really representing
your business. We know some people that are very good at that, and others.
Yeah. That's a great idea. Okay, let's go to you, Lynn, on this. How do we tell a story once we've done an achievement? We want to kind of maximize the internal PR in that.
Yeah, so I'm a big advocate. I've learned this one, that you go outside, get people outside to pay attention, and all of a sudden people inside are interested. It works every time. And the second thing is, you don't wait till you're done. You do it from the beginning. So you've got to be telling the story from the beginning and constantly articulating where you're at, what's going on, what you're winning at, how this is operating. It is because it's about momentum, right? If you wait until the whole story's over and tell it, people are like, dude, that's yesterday's business, right? I mean, done.
I love it. It's basically, it's like a Netflix series, not a big, right, like Lord of the Rings movie, right? It's like, you got to just keep hitting people with the next episode.
Right.
Keep the like constant flow of information out there. Okay, Ben, we're going to you with this. Any thoughts on how to amplify once you've done a win?
Yeah, I'm going to answer this in a little bit of a different view, but I know about 5-10 minutes earlier we talked about blockers and knockers. Make them blockers and knockers your biggest amplifier of your success, because usually if you turn them people around, they will be your biggest advocates, because they're the biggest people that you've had to fight to get the respect. So again, just going back over my career, especially at Yodel, supply chain, people that didn't really care about hiring, it's just bums on seats or people delivering parcels. But once you turn their heads into how strategic and value add talent acquisition can be, game over. You've done your job.
Mm-hmm. So you can almost measure it. So let's say you have a limited amount of energy or amount of time, but if you identify people that have been strong up sort of antagonist to you, you allocate a little bit more time or pretty energy much to them to make sure, can we convert them?
Because obviously there's no point trying to win over people that are our fans anyway, because they're already it's like an election, isn't it? It's 40% vote for them, 40% vote. Right. It's that kind of thing. So if you try to win
we
over
can neglect people, the North, always going to vote Labour, forget about them.
We don't talk about politics where I'm from, because it's bad news anyway. But yeah, like I said, try to, it's all about winning. And I think this might be a good way to end. You know, it's about winning hearts and minds. Let's win the hearts and minds of people that are critical, because I think they're going to be the biggest fans, really.
Yeah. All right. And cool. Let me build on that, because there's one other quick point. My big thing is going to be, and name names. When you talk about the success, I mean, we just did this with a client the other day. He said, hey, these two recruiters just had phenomenal success, and they got the spotlight by name. When you can go back to a division head and say, three of your hiring managers, you know, did X, Y, and Z, and look what happened. Everyone loves to be named in a success story, right? Success has many fathers. Whenever you can throw sunshine on individual people, they're happy they did it. People want to be part of your tribe and part of your movement. Don't just go to the point, not just data, you want the data, but put some names to it. So you've got folks that get the recognition for having joined the party.
Humanize it. And again, this is not just your team. This is your hiring managers. This is the people who've been involved in some way in the flow. Or
The compliance people, whomever. Yeah, get them out there. Give them some sunshine. Yeah.
Fantastic. Amazing. And finally, I was about to say, I mean, we talked about Netflix before, and also this idea of constant communication. Maybe this is actually an application for video technology also. Like, if you're able to give video updates to people and to have a very compelling, hey, folks, this has just happened. We're launching this. Let's see how we go. As you say, don't wait until you're done. Be brave enough to talk about it before, you know, really before you know, have determined the outcome. And then just keep updating them, even if it doesn't work out to optimal level. I think people will internally respect the fact you've been open with it, and you're not waiting to announce something, you know, once you've guaranteed the win. So that is fascinating. Okay, we're out of time, everybody. So what an amazing show. I think we could keep talking on this topic. Maybe it's worth a round two, but I think we've got a very good number of points on the different parts of the transformation journey. So it might be worth writing this up at some point, I think. That's about it, everybody. Let's say goodbye to our friends. So thank you very much, Ben. Great to see you, sir. Thanks, we'll hopefully catch up again soon. And Paul, great to see you again. Let's make sure we're hanging out next time you're in London or whatever. Let me know.
Cool. Love to.
And Lynn, great to see you. Wonderful to see you. Thank you so much for getting up so early in the day. Hopefully you don't need to drink any more coffee.
There's going to be so much coffee happening today, but good. It's going to
keep going. Thanks so much. But listen, we'll have to catch up at another time as well. Love to see what you're doing with the new business and also the wonderful podcast you're running as well. So you have a very good day. Great weekend as well.
Bye, Lynn.
Hey. Cool. That was great, wasn't it? How interesting was that? I really enjoyed having conversation with smart people, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Aubrey was good. You know, the one point that came up in the chat that I didn't want to derail what was going on, but was the comment that if you're really solving someone's problem, they won't necessarily block you. You know, if someone's got a real problem and you come in with the right solution that, you know, doesn't have too big a cost in it, I think too often TA people are worried about implementing change because they're afraid they won't get the support. They're afraid to ask a hiring manager to do something extra. They're worried that, you know, if they change things, they're not going to have cooperation. But then you got to go back, are you really solving their problem? Because oftentimes, you know, we find much less resistant. I mean, we see it with video all the time. Oh, our hiring managers won't make videos. And the hiring managers just need the hires. And if they need to make a 20-second video, it's like, let me have it. You know, if you solve my problem and you can get me that hire today, fine. So sometimes we're too afraid of change.
I think that's actually a really good point. And I hope the people who are hanging around at the tail end of the show catch it as well, because we can underestimate how much the business might actually want to help. Sometimes there's going to be a percentage of people who never help. Let's face it. In any business, I mean, 10% will just literally never help. But then there's 10% that will always going to help. They're just like motivated to the business. And if you're going to find who those are, they could be great advocates, great support. I remember one of the very first like internal TA jobs I did, I was going nowhere with it because I was trying to do it all myself. And it was just too much work, couldn't do it. But then I started speaking with some of the people in the business, and they were afraid of it contributing because they thought I was like very territorial. Said, this is what I'm doing. And I was thinking, oh my God, how have I messaged this? They need to, absolutely, you can help, you know? And once we cleared that out, then suddenly it was like we were humming. So very, very
10% important. Who will never help. You've got 10% who will always help. Then you've got 80% who just want their problem solved. know, and you shouldn't be afraid of those 80%. If you approach them appropriately with a solution that really works, I mean, I think people do get surprised. They're often the biggest part of failure is they don't try. They just, well, let's put it out there and see if anybody does this. Like, no. Let's go out there and present it with all of its possibilities, and then keep reinforcing the success we're having. It really does work.
And the success becomes a bit formal, doesn't it? Like someone might think, "Oh, why am I not getting mentioned? Maybe I should put some effort in recruiting." It's like, yes, you should. And then suddenly you get more people coming in. That's great. Okay, that's about it, everybody. Thanks so much for watching the show. If you've enjoyed this conversation, make sure you follow the channel. We do this every week. Next week, we are going to be talking about how to set compensation for a remote only team. So this should be super interesting for anybody who's thinking about, we're in the remote world now. That's all well and good, but how are you going to set the comp, particularly if you've already got legacy sort of structure in place that may no longer quite match with, you know, how it works now that you've opened it up with a remote anywhere situation. So we've got a few compensation and benefits experts with us. We've got people who've designed these systems before. It's a topic I would recommend you check out. That's about it. Have a good weekend, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay, Lynn. Not Lynn. Maury, hang around for a sec. Hang around for a sec.
Absolutely.
There's been a screw up. There's been a screw up, I'm afraid to say, because even though our conversation went really well, there was no technical problems with us and Crowdcast, but this for some reason did not go out on any of these social channels as it should have done. So I need to investigate why that is. It's probably human error. Maybe it's something I've done. Or it could be a technical error, in which case I'll figure out why that is. But regardless of the case, that's disappointing. And what I'll do is I'll make it up to you in one of two ways. So you've got a choice on this. You can chew down on this if you want. I'm going to give you a free slot so we can repeat this later on in the year. We've got another couple left, so I'll just give you the next one of that if you're for it. Or we can give you a free Founders Focus interview, which is, again, you and me one-on-one. And we can do that as kind of a compensation for this as well. Let me know. I'll do some investigation what it is. I think it's human error. I hope it is, because it means it won't happen next week. But if it's a technical problem, then obviously that's an issue. But regardless of the cause, you got that offer on. Okay, no worries. Great to have you, Maury. You have a very good day. We'll catch you soon. Okay.
Okay, that's good. Great. Thanks, Hang. Bye bye.
Cool. All right. That's it. My back's aching. The sun is out, though. I might go out to the park and, get some sunshine. Is it too early? It's still January. I don't know. I need some vitamin D, though.